Thomas B. Taylor, Associate Professor of Church History and Old Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
We're beginning this morning a series of talks on the book of Ecclesiastes, one of the most interesting of the Old Testament books, locked squarely in the middle of the poetic sections of the Old Testament. Our projection is for the first one being a talk with regard to the introduction of the book and the prologue materials. Following that, we will discuss four major discourses in Ecclesiastes, one talk at a time. I will give the chapter and verse divisions on those somewhat later in this discussion today. And then as I identify four main themes in Ecclesiastes, we will look at the scriptures and ideas that support it and back it up and try to draw our conclusions from that. We will have one final one which will discuss the conclusion of the book of Ecclesiastes, offer a few technical aspects and ramifications on the book, and draw our study to a close. That's what we project to do in this particular series of talks. We don't propound to take every aspect and every problem and every question, but we hope to look at the major themes and major ideas in the book in such a way that it can be followed both biblically and theologically to the edification of those who are concerned with the total truth of the Word of God. The book of Ecclesiastes starts out in striking fashion, and that beginning in chapter 1 is wrapped up in the last few verses of chapter 12, where the writer says to us, "Because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge." With these words, the writer tells us the overall purpose and plan of his book. It is none less than to aid the flock in having right values, setting proper goals, giving honest judgment to temporal things, and learning to appreciate the goodness of God. To do those things, the writer of Ecclesiastes has prepared a lengthy lesson in which the essentials of all those matters are set forth. Seemingly, when we read the book on a cursory way, it is a negative approach, for so much of man's world is empty and hopeless. But positively, the lessons of Ecclesiastes are to honor God and to live in the light of his judgments. This is a timeless message, needed today as it was then, and spelled out by an investigative thinker who had both the time and the means to make the study in depth. Too much is often said of the vehicle of Ecclesiastes and not enough of the message. We sometimes worry about the words and the phrases and the grammar, but forget the heart of the point behind them. The vehicle, frankly, is the dry, caustic, almost pessimistic manner in which the author views the events of life. But the message is to the effect that life is meaningful only when lived in the knowledge of the Lord. That the vehicle obscures the message is apparent in the reading of many present commentaries. But if the two are kept in balance, vehicle and message, that is, the force of how the word is given enriches the content of what's said. If the arrangement of Ecclesiastes seems cryptic to us today, it may be the result of our overwhelming desire to obtain the greatest amount of content with the least work possible. In talking about the basic things behind Ecclesiastes, let me count out five or six positive points before we actually come to the text itself. First of all, some of the characteristics of the book. Ecclesiastes is a book of human experience. As such, it shows an intense experimentation in the affairs of life. This leads to a representation of a living effort to explore and formulate life meaning in an experimental way, and the language of the writer frequently demonstrates the frustration of this sort of activity. Human experience does not lessen the quality of the material in the book, for this stuff, human experience, is that of which we are all made. Realistic and experimental content is not inferior to theoretical or prescriptive content. Human experience is useful or damaging, depending on the set of the mind and the value of the concerned party. In Ecclesiastes, the experiences of the author do not lessen the authority with which he speaks. Rather, they tend to demonstrate the reality of practical truth and support the didactic portions on which the writer passes on advice to us. We know that what he's saying is right because he has done it, seen it, and knows about it. So in this book, we have the analysis of one man's experience as he sought to determine the mind and will of man and God. The vast majority of things treated are under the sun, events in the life and experience of us all to some greater or lesser extent. So that really is the first thing in characterizing Ecclesiastes. It is a book of experience, real events that happen to a real man with real and practical observations available to us all. The book is also characterized by what I like to call a rational view. It's a reasoned discourse in which the writer trusts his mental processes to lead and direct him in conclusive ways. The logic is strikingly clear, and the conclusions are unescapable, enough to make many readers feel uncomfortable. A factor of this sort is in keeping with the experimental nature. If the writer can become involved in an empirical sense, it is only reasonable that he should be able to tell us about it in a logical way. Keen reasoning demonstrates itself on every side, and following its leading to emphatic statements, colorfully describes the methodology of the work. Ecclesiastes is not a book where you don't think. You have to follow progressively, step by step, act by act, the lines of thinking of the author, to see first what he concludes, and then to tie his conclusions with other points. But along with that, Ecclesiastes is also characterized by strong, earthy language. Although the poetic idiom sometimes soars to great heights, as in chapter 3 in the famous poem of Time, it is always in words that come within the understanding of the general reader. This is also true of the figurative expressions and the general imagery. It is death and labor and judgment, keen words that are easily understood by anybody. It's true that the vocabulary of the work employs many words which are not found elsewhere in the Old Testament. Sometimes it gives new forms to words that are found throughout the Scripture. But these are still terms that are quickly self-defined and representative of what one might be expected to know. The writer talks of experiences that are common and gives illustrations which most readers have already seen in the course of life, or at least find very quickly that they are credible in degree. Those are the main concepts in Ecclesiastes as far as describing the book is concerned. Its appeal to experimentation, reason, and to the strong, sensible language of people very much as we are. The second concept in introducing Ecclesiastes is the matter of the inspiration of the book. This is often debated and hotly argued over among scholars in various areas. So I will not try to answer every question on it here, although we will take up many of them as we go through the work. But there are a number of notes that have to be made with regard to it. First of all, in the light of the characteristics, it is perhaps not surprising that some commentators have wondered about the inspiration of Ecclesiastes. The weight of human experience and reasoning brings a doubt regarding the correctness of the procedure or the findings, and some have thought of the book as only being inspired recording of uninspired doings. But in thinking of this concept, there are a few items that must be kept in mind and will therefore prove helpful to us. In other words, if somebody says, here we have the inspired account of uninspired doings, there are two or three things that have to be borne in mind before that can be accepted as a valid point. The first of those is that human experience may be either good or bad. In Ecclesiastes, the human experience says, plural, are not good, but the human experience, singular, is good. What the writer does often leaves us empty, but what he learns from it enables us to be full. The experience of many disappointments prepares him for the experience of satisfaction. Since he could not have known rightfully the latter without the former, it should not be thought that the former were inferior or out of keeping with the life of a thoughtful man. I hope that's not too complicated. But what I'm trying to say is just this, that before one can come to real meaning, one must run the risk of several disappointments. If the end result of the disappointments is success, then the total experience is good. The writer simply tells us the path that he pursued to come to the place where he knew that only God gives meaning to life. As he moves through the experiences of life, he learns what is observed by many others in the framework of Revelation, that it is the very emptiness of our lives that makes the knowledge of God the more important. This experience demonstrates with us what is found throughout Scripture. Man in himself is never fully satisfied and ultimately depends on the knowledge of God for all that is meaningful. Now let us back up for a moment. Therefore, if one of them says that the book of Ecclesiastes is the inspired account of uninspired doings, we quickly stop and say, you have to be careful how you say that. In the book of Kings, there are many battles that are fought that were not inspired battles, but the record of them is accurate. Many things happen in the Gospels, which in themselves could have happened or might not have happened, but the record is accurate. So the fact that human experiences are involved does not take away from the inspiration of the book. The book is inspired because the message is correct and the authorship is correct. In the case of Ecclesiastes, I will argue that although some of the experiences were bad, the end result of them was good, and therefore the inspiration is not only of message, but of the vehicle as well. God said to him, do it this way, and come out with these conclusions. But that's one of those things that must be borne in mind as one proceeds. To say that it is the inspired record of uninspired events would be true of just about all of sacred history. Now, without beating that any further, I think, let me mention the second concept with regard to inspiration. Secondly, the character of God in Ecclesiastes is seen in a very consistent way with the general pattern of Scripture. God is not an afterthought to coalesce, and certainly not a blind destiny. The Lord of whom the book speaks is a personal and intimate creator. As the author proceeds through what appears to be emptiness to him and his world, the person of God makes up for every deficiency. And this appreciation for the person of God aligns this book with those other scripture books that tell the greatness and wonder of the dealings of the Lord. There is nothing recorded in Ecclesiastes that suggests inferiority about God or about his dealings. He is set on the highest pinnacle, and his events are seen to be those which correctly order our lives. Then for another thought with regard to inspiration, it's been suggested that the findings of the writer of Ecclesiastes are not in agreement with other scriptures. This requires a more detailed study that will have to come in various sections of the book, but the portions that are thought to lack agreement are usually found to be in great harmony when the full picture is seen. The statement in Ecclesiastes 9, for example, where the writer says, there is no work, etc., in the grave where thou goest, is not tending to tell of an annihilation, but to indicate the cessation of the normal works of earth in the afterlife. It does not deny an existence beyond the grave, but emphatically declares that the works one is now working on will not be finished in the grave. That's an awfully important point. I hope to make talks on the subject of Ecclesiastes in connection with this series. But if I die after the third one, I will not come back to make the fourth one. Now, presumably. I don't think there's much danger of it happening. They will be finished. Someone else may make them, or someone may destroy the first three. But it would seem unlikely that I would be able to come back and finish the task, because even though I expect my soul to be with Jesus and in glory, I am confidently told there are no tape recorders there, and that if there are, there is no communication service for mailing back the cassettes from that beautiful place. So you have to take things like that in Ecclesiastes 9 in agreement with the totality of the teaching of Scripture. In chapter 12, the writer tells us that the words of the wise, which he's been collecting, are like goads, words given from one shepherd. There he makes a forthright claim to having God as the source of his wisdom, understanding, and advice. Therefore, we don't have to worry about the correctness of his conclusions, nor the adequacy of his experimentation. His views carry the same force as with any didactic literature, and in saying this, we fully recognize that all relevant scriptures on any doctrine must be studied before it is thought of as being complete. The book of Ecclesiastes and its inspiration was never challenged among the Jews, accepted in the earliest canons of scripture as far as we know them, and stands in my mind as being a book of prime material. Not just the inspired record of uninspired deeds, but the inspired record of truth. As by many experiences that tend to deteriorate, one is able to determine the experience which is correct and meaningful for life. I should say that if one does not read carefully, he will find all sorts of mistakes, not only in Ecclesiastes, but in John and Matthew and every place else. They are only mistakes in the mind of the quick reader. The individual, for example, reads the scripture that the sun rises and the sun sets and concludes that the writers had a false cosmology. You'll discover that sunrise and sunset are still part of the naval almanac, but we think that the men in Annapolis have a pretty good idea of what they mean by that. And we think the Bible writers have that same good understanding, too. Now, in our introductory material, the third thing is to mention something of the aim of the book. First, we discuss the characteristics, and second, we discuss the concept of inspiration, and third, a few notes on the aim of the book. Ecclesiastes seeks to show that the normal things in which people place hope are meaningless in themselves. That's it. Its intention is to get the reader beyond these things and to the realm where truth and meaning may be found through yieldness to God. Knowing God is the key to understanding and appreciating everything else. We are told this in Ecclesiastes 1:13, and the general theme is repeated often. Through participation in events, coalesce will show that actual participation in the world of men is empty in itself, even when one can go to the fullest possible extent in that participation. This aim must be understood if the book is to be meaningful, and it finds a succinct commentary in the words of John 14, "Without me, you can do nothing." With great care and method, the author reaches to remove from us every trace of a doubt about the satisfaction of this world's goods in themselves. That's the key claim of Ecclesiastes, that your hope in education and money and goods and prominence and fame is worthless if God is not the source and the object of it. The fourth point in our consideration of Ecclesiastes from an introductory point of view is the organization of the book. It is really a rather loose arrangement of prose arguments, poetic tributes, and aphoristic statements. Aphoristic statement would be like a proverb, a short, wise, pithy expression. It combines Hebrew prose and poetry in very original form and changes mode of expression without warning. At times, the reader might feel like in Proverbs. At other times, it may seem to be among the prophets. Occasionally, the mood is that of the sacred Psalter. The literary figure moves quickly from one place to another, centering on certain recurring subjects, life, possessions, learning, amusement, death. This gives Ecclesiastes the appearance of having little order of continuity or plot, and among other things, it makes a neatly structured outline almost impossible. This complicates the public presentation of the book. With no easy outline, there is no ready-made pattern of recapitulation, and the repetition of recurring ideas may become monotonous. Thus, many public presentations of Ecclesiastes have been given in the form of mere text-taking and lecturing on those texts. This does not give a view of the whole book and may overlook some of the passages more perplexing as well as those most needful. The proper organization seems to be the notation that the book is comprised of key and recurring themes. If we look for themes rather than structured outline material, and if we place the material that relates to the various themes together in proper sequence, the book loses its seeming confusion, and the repetition of ideas becomes a means of driving home a point. Although later in our discussion we will do a lot of work chapter by chapter and verse by verse, Ecclesiastes is not easily studied that way because of the repetition of themes. It is more easily and logically studied with the themes, as long as the themes are kept close to the sacred text. Ultimately, the end of the themes accords with the aim of the book. Man's ambitions are fruitless if the will of God is not honored in them. Instinctively, men may know that life does not consist in the possessions, but with head and heart, men prefer to hope that it may. So when Coeleth, with his very realistic view of life, forces one to see the facts, the reader may be slightly appalled or frightened. His themes together dash all of our physical and purely human aspirations on the reefs of time. And that, of course, is his aim. And that is what he does. The organization bends with the aim to give us a picture of utter hopelessness if God is not foremost in our thinking and being. The fifth item that we discuss in an introductory sense then would be these dominant themes. We will look at them in greater detail in later talks. But precise ideas in Ecclesiastes may be stated in interrogative form as well as in a more formal declarative mode. In a questioning sense, the writer is continuously occupied with such questions as, what's the substance of life? What really makes it up? What's the end of life? Where are we headed? What is the aftermath of life? For what can we look? How do we stand responsibly in the face of our destiny? What profit do we have in thinking about even these things? What are the factors that control or condition our lives? Such questions are too much for us and too fast for us. But they are in the hearts of men in almost all settings of life. Coeleth or Ecclesiastes simply pushes them to their logical conclusion. The writer avoids simplistic answers but will seek to tell us that the substance of life is more than sense perception and sense pleasures, that the end of life is more than just dying, that the aftermath is more than simply facing the unknown, and that even though man may seem to be subject to a fate which he can't control, he is still responsible in the face of his destiny. These points are hammered out as he tells us that knowledge fails, possessions are empty, pleasant moments are swift passages. Reputation is lost at the moment, and the soul is left unsustained in a difficult world unless an attachment is found with the God who gives life and meaning. Facing such matters as these, we see that Ecclesiastes is not a book of fatalism. but a book that calls man to look responsibly towards what God is doing and what he, man, must do. Unfortunately, the force of the text is one for which men are not well prepared. Our estimates of our own strength are so far beyond the facts that when the facts are presented, we are unwilling to cope with them, very often at least. The writer does not want us to give up, but to look to God. It becomes a meaningful possibility only when we see our inherent weakness and lack of absolute ability. Firstly, the themes utilized draw one to this point. Education, pleasure, prominence, gain are nothing if God is not fundamental to them. In the sixth consideration, we want to talk about the interpretation of the book. If one presumes to read many of the commentaries in this book, you will quickly discover that in some circles the text has fallen on troubled days and the message of Coelus has been assigned to a low level of usefulness. More recently, there have been signs of a helpful return. With many random reading of commentaries or study Bibles, it becomes plain that the approach to the book determines much of the final evaluation. A hermeneutic is of great importance, particularly as we study a book where obscurity is possible. Generally speaking, the only satisfying hermeneutic is that every passage is to be taken in its literal sense, unless, in the first place, there is a flat statement of the contrary, or in the second, the literal sense would involve some absurdity or bring ridicule on the name of God, or in the third, parallel passages and related materials suggest some meaning other than literal as the intended message. Literal in this sense means simply that the words used accurately describe the thing involved in an objective, open way. Literal language may well be marked with speech figures and devices, but the figurative language will simply accurately conform to what the figures represent. If we bring this hermeneutic to Ecclesiastes, we are starting at the same place where we begin with a study of John or any other biblical book, and that is one of the points I try to make in my consideration of the book. We come to Ecclesiastes on exactly the same basis, with exactly the same assumptions, with exactly the same methodology that we would come to John, Revelation, Exodus, or the Gospels. Perhaps the principle is used with more difficulty in this book, due to the earthy language and the rationalistic conclusion. Students must work from the negative to the positive, as Coelus first destroys a number of items and later replaces them with positive elements. For this reason, some are overwhelmed by the negative and attempt to leave the literal means of understanding. But literality is not just a convenience in Ecclesiastes, it is something without which we cannot do. The infallible rule of scripture interpretation is scripture itself, as we are told in the confession and as we believe. Therefore, for every observation and point in Ecclesiastes, there is one essential question that must be asked. Does it harmonize with the rest of the biblical picture? If it does, there is no resultant problem, regardless of a certain negative posture that may occur. If it does not, we may need to seek whether or not the literal understanding is correct. The important factor is to begin a study of the passage with the concept that God has spoken, and our aim is to understand what he has said. In this framework, we will be able to look at many of the varied concepts of Coelus to see what he says. We can treat the poetic and figurative passages precisely as we treat similar literature in other parts of the Old Testament. The didactic portions may be given a harmonious approach, and the ultimate conclusions of the book may be brought to our attention and thought with force and clarity. If we interpret this book precisely as we would any other, we may come to it with no fear of contradiction of stated truth. We may not be pleased with some of the teachings, but that is a defect in us, not in the biblical revelation. For our seventh observation in introducing the book, we look at the ways in which it may be analyzed. There are many ways in which it may be discussed. In the Sesson Law talks, we will use two ways. First, we will analyze the book on a section-by-section or discourse-by-discourse basis, noting the particular verses and chapters as they work for the arguments of the writer. Following this, we will discuss the book by summarizing the major themes and teachings of each theme within the book itself. As I mentioned earlier, the latter is the better way of working with Ecclesiastes, but if we neglect a verse-by-verse consideration of some parts of it, we will miss many interesting things. So for this study, we will try to use something of both methods, and while this may make for slight repetition of material at times, it will allow us to maximize the concepts of the content of the book. For convenience, we have divided Ecclesiastes into six parts. This is an arrangement that not everyone would agree with, but it seems to go well with my particular schedule and understanding of the book. There is a prologue in which the writer sets forth the basic ideas about man and his world as the author of the book sees him. This material is Ecclesiastes 1, 1 through 11. The prologue, Ecclesiastes 1, 1 through 11. This is followed by four discourses which we may summarize as follows. Ecclesiastes 1, 12 through 2, 26. That is, 1, 12 through 2, 26 is the first discourse with a discussion of the facts of life. Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 3, 12. 3, 1 through 3, 12 is the second discourse in which our movements in time before man and God are considered. The third discourse is Ecclesiastes 7:1 through 9:12. 7:1 through 9:12, and the content seeks to correct unacceptable life views. The fourth discourse is Ecclesiastes 9:13 through 12:7. Ecclesiastes 9:13 through 12:7. In it, we are given needed advice for the years of our life in this passage. Let me pause and point out that there is a natural order to the four discourses. The first one tells us the bare facts of life. The second one tells us how time augments our life as we move with God and men. The third one corrects views in our minds which may not be right. And the fourth one gives us the appropriate amount of advice for the spending of our years until the time comes when God calls. These four discourses then are followed with the sixth part, which we simply call an epilogue, and find in Ecclesiastes 12, 8 through 14. Both the prologue, Ecclesiastes 1, 1 through 11, and the epilogue, Ecclesiastes 12, 8 through 14, are in some ways less important than the total discourses, and yet without them the book would be lost. For in the prologue, the writer tells, in essence, what he observes and what gives rise to the writing of the book. And in the epilogue, he tells why he has done it and fulfills his hopes and aspirations in the message of it. We may note that the outline of the book along those lines is not uniform among scholars, but we feel that it will work well as far as our presentations and considerations are concerned in this treatment. Chapter divisions in Ecclesiastes do not divide systematically with the nature of the material, but what we have tried to do is to take the concepts of major themes and keep them consistent with some basic nature of chapter and verse divisions. The treatment of the discourses will follow a common pattern. As we come to each portion, we will give a discussion of an overall theme for the section. Then we will look at the particular verses within the section that argue for it, and then draw things to a conclusion when it happens to be over. And in treating the four discourses that way, we will have some good concept of them and of their particular meaning. Now, all of these things have been said in an introductory sense, and it makes a long introduction. I'm only mildly apologetic for that. There are a lot of other things we could discuss: authorship, dates, canon, a whole bunch of things, some of which I will try to say in the last discussion in this series of talks. But what we've tried to do essentially here is to talk about the characteristics of the book, the aim of the book, the inspiration of the book, the manner in which the book is studied, and the particular approach that we are going to use as we come to it. That sets the foundation for our beginning of a study of Ecclesiastes as it stands. And we will begin at this point by talking about the first section of Ecclesiastes, the prologue, which is found in Ecclesiastes 1, 1 through 11. The prologue of Ecclesiastes, chapters 1, 1 through 11. It discusses facts about man and his world. Of man and his world. And these verses in Ecclesiastes 1, 1 through 11 stretch our minds as they show a man who is not around very much and a world who's around a lot. I will read these sections verse by verse as we discuss it. But let me note these things in a preliminary sense. Prologue words, Ecclesiastes 1, 1 through 11, sound gloomy to most readers, but they present a very factual picture. It's the simple truth that there is no lasting and meaningful substance to man's life in this physical world. You are not going to be here forever. You are certainly not going to be here very long. In truth, all of man's experience and being is a passing shadow, a dim mirage, or an empty vision in the world where he lives and moves physically. This world receives most of our attention and occupies an overwhelmingly large amount of our thoughts and hardly be argued. Therefore, the words of Coelho are particularly disturbing. While all else has a course and a program, man runs his days and is no more. The statements of the author sound fatalistic at worst, simply pessimistic at best. Perhaps it is this beginning of the book that has given so many readers a negative attitude about the message. It is indeed a grim premise on which it's based. But the overall teaching of these verses is just that simple. Man's life has no real substance or lasting qualities to it. All he has is elusive and illusionary. Perhaps the best one could say is that what he has is like a vapor one breathes on a cold morning. It appears in the air, but when one reaches for it, it is gone. If you do not know that, then you are unprepared to look at life in full and proper balance. And the writer of Ecclesiastes in his prologue tries to make it emphatic that we should know it indeed. We are here but for a season, and we are frustrated by the shortness of that time. The text of Ecclesiastes begins thus. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. The authorship of Ecclesiastes is a debated subject, and these words do not identify the author by name. Koheleth is king in Jerusalem, and it's generally thought that this necessitates one of the Judean kings, probably one who lived before the division of the kingdom. Only three could qualify under these terms, and only one reasonably suggested among these. That one would be Solomon. But the matter is not conclusive just by the words of this verse. Every Judean king was a son of David. Likewise, they were all king in Jerusalem, although this verse is amplified in Ecclesiastes 1:12 when the writer tells us that he was king over Israel in Jerusalem. But even so, Israel might be used in the general sense to describe the Hebrew people as the sons of Jacob, rather than to be indicating the Northern Union in particular. Preacher is the Hebrew word koheleth. That's why I've been using it back and forth. Some Bibles will translate Ecclesiastes as the preacher. Preacher is the Hebrew word koheleth, a designation used to describe the whole book. The term is derived from the Hebrew word meaning to gather, to collect, and it's thought that koheleth was the one who either gathered the children of Israel together in order that he might give some type of instruction, or one who gathered the words of instruction that he might give them to the people. Either idea is possible. He is the collector either of the people or of the truth. But he brings them together that they might hear what he has to say. And so he says, I, the preacher, the son of David, existed as king of Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the writer in verse 2. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Vanity means emptiness or breathiness, perhaps nothingness. It's a concept of something which is elusive or illusionary. When you grab for it, you find that there's nothing but emptiness in your hand. Popular commentators have rendered it as everything from soap bubbles to steam vapor. They're trying hard to find a way to show that something appears with a degree of meaning, but when tested, is found to be illusionary. The compounded term, vanity of vanities, is an expression of a superlative state. Nothing is more vain than this. One must understand that Koheleth is not saying there are no physical realities. The desk that I'm leaning on is real. But he is saying that when it comes to meaning, real substance is not in a visible estate. You cannot grab it and hold on to it. How much is included in the term the whole is vanity is a problem at this point in the study. But here, it seems to be an all-inclusive term, and perhaps special definition must await further notice. But it certainly includes the world of sense perception and man's attainment. Whether it involves internal realities or not, we will have to note later. Don't feel alarmed when the writer says all is vanity. Think of the happiest day of your life and think how short it was. Or think how quickly a dish of ice cream melts and is no more. All those substances to which we look prove to be just experiences which we cannot hold to and can only enjoy for a short season. Verse 3, what profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? Now the question is rhetorical. It does not relate to economics or goods. It doesn't ask if you're making money. It asks simply, what does one get out of all of his work? Realistically, Koheleth is suggesting tacitly, is life worth all this struggle? Perhaps the profit is merely internal satisfaction, but has the idea of that which is left over, which abounds. What abounds out of all this work? Koheleth would like to see it in terms of a better shaped description than simply internal satisfaction. What abounds out of all this labor? Labor suggests hard work and enterprise, not necessarily manual toil. The laboring methods of a portrait painter and a miner are rather different, but the expenditure of energy and interest is about the same. Therefore, any assertive enterprise may be seen as a labor and every man a laborer. Even the idle person dreams and spins his web to the exhaust of his mind. The most lazy become worn and anxious for sleep at the end of an uneventful day. From every man's exercise, the question is asked, what is the profit? The expression under the sun is a limited expression, suggesting the application is to one's personal sphere as it is known in this life. In a literary sense, the sun governs the world, and things done under it are those against common to this life. While a limited experience is not inferior, nor does it lack spiritual interest or comprehension, none of those things, it does confine the observation and suggests a lack of knowledge about things beyond the sun. In fact, it may suggest that the true values lie in another world or state of affairs. The expression is similar to the one of the chapter 1, verse 13, under heaven. The term simply describes life as you know it, lived in the sphere of this planet. Verse 4, one generation passes away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abides forever. This verse begins a series of verses through verse 9 showing the transient nature of man in a universe which seems to be substantial. They should not be taken in such a literal sense as to destroy their integrity, as some may do with the word forever, interpreting it as meaning all time. The term may well mean any age, and does not have to be given the thought of eternity. When the writer says the world abides forever, he does not mean that there is not going to be a new heaven and a new earth someday. He merely means as far as this age is concerned, the earth is continually standing. Generations come and go, but the earth is here. Well, some are born and some are buried, but the earth is here. The action is depicted with a series of Hebrew participles. One generation coming, one generation, another generation going, but the earth standing and awaiting the coming of the next generation. So a family tree may show dozens of generations, but they are all gone and going while the earth continues very much as it has been. Chapter 1, verse 5 continues this. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to the place where he arose. The sun goes up, and the sun goes down. I can think of a half dozen modern songs with words to that effect in them. Like the one from Fiddler on the Roof, sunrise, sunset, swiftly go the days. It is a striking way to describe the monotony of existence, and that's what the writer is doing. He is not teaching that the sun runs around the earth. He is simply saying that as we live, one day comes and one day goes. When we are young, time seems to drag. When we are older, it bounds ahead. And even though science tells us that all days proceed at the same rate, Coalesce says they seem to speed up and flee from us. The earth is steady, but we are going. The sun continues a regular pattern, but we are failing. Verse 6 continues this thought. The wind goeth toward the south and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth continually, and the wind returneth again according to its surface. Have you ever wondered what happens to the wind after it blows? I'm not sure that's an intelligent question, but when one stands on a cliff and feels a breeze blowing across one's face, does one stop and say, I wonder what happened to that breeze? Did it go out over the middle of the ocean and fall in? Does it die or does it wreck on the side of a sea ship? What happens to that breeze? Well, says Coalesce, that breeze goes around and around, and there's no way of starting it and no way of stopping it. It moves continually. It follows a cycle of its own, not in a meteorological analysis, but in a brief description of what happens. It follows a cycle of its own, but it continues, and it's there, and it's there, and it's there, but you are not. That's the circumstance with man and his world. The earth and the sun and the breeze are here, but you're here and gone. In verse 7, the writer continues this rather strange way to begin a book. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. This doesn't need much of a commentary. The writer is not giving us a geographical discussion of how water moves through the earth, but he is pointing out that the river runs perpetually, and its source is not dried up, neither is the sea full. Somehow the water gets down and returns to the source from which it came. It may not be the very water to the very place. But water vapor gets to the ocean, gets back to where it comes from. If I pour a bucket of water out in the room, before long the bucket is empty, and presumably the room is wet, but the bucket is empty. But that's not the way it is with the springs in the mountains. The water comes back through the snow, refills the springs, and they flow again and again and again. All things, says the writer in verse 8, continuing this discussion, are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, the ear filled with hearing. So the writer is simply saying there that everything is work. Nothing is easy. It takes work to have enjoyment, and that suggests that nothing comes of itself. Your eye is not satisfied with seeing, because just seeing a thing makes the eye want to experience it, and if the eye cannot experience it, it is unhappy. The ear is not just satisfied with hearing. The ear wants to experience it. If it cannot, it's unhappy. Therefore, both the eye and the ear hear and see and want more and more. They not only want the acquisition of other things, but they want the experience of other things.
So they're not just satisfied to look, and they're not just satisfied to hear, and neither are you. It's like looking at a dinner and not being able to eat it. We are not made filled that way from our, well, we're not given deliverance from our appetite that way. If a meal is placed before me, looking at it or hearing about it is not what I want. Eating it is what I desire. So the writer says, look at your eye and look at your ear. Your eye sees thousands of things. It's not satisfied with them. Your ear hears thousands of things. It's not satisfied with them. And any effort you make to satisfy them involves a countless amount of labor. Drawing his thoughts towards the conclusion, verse 9, the writer says, the thing which hath been, it is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun. The verse is often quoted humorously and sometimes quoted to speak against people's inventions. But actually, the writer is not talking about the existence of physical things, but of the life processes. These are not new. What one is doing now in his process has been done before. What one is thinking, planning, hoping, imagining has all been done before, maybe by yourself and certainly by others. If technology were in mind, then the writer would hardly be correct. There are some things technologically that are new, but the idea of invention is not new. And so when you sit down and say, I'm going to invent something new, what you invent may be new, but the processes of thought that lead to it are not new. The writer concludes that in verse 10 by saying, is there anything whereof you may say it's new? And the writer says, it is not. It has been before us. Not the physical objects, but the reality of the life processes and what man aims for. Furthermore, says the writer in verse 11, there is no remembrance of those former things. Neither shall there be in remembrance of those things that are to come with those things that shall come after. No remembrance doesn't mean you can't call them to mind, but there is no special attention paid to them. They are quickly gone. And so you'll see things that are very monumental today, and you'll say, I will remember it forever, but you may not remember it more than a few moments. And the next man who thinks of it may think with great arrogance that it is a new thing. Eventually, it means that no matter how much one works or how much one strives, one is still a passing person in a seemingly stable universe, unable to break out of a straitjacket of time, life, and experience, and unable to liberate oneself into self-continuance like the sun, wind, or the world itself. This is the problem of the prologue. The world is a continuing cycle, set in its development by a great divine mind that succeeds in giving itself continuance and independence on a stage where the actors come and go. You, the actor, would like to remain behind and find some permanent place, but you cannot do it. Instead, we find only frustrations as we see the things in life that seem meaningful to us continue while we pass away. The world is a continuing entity, but man is a discontinuing individual. Vanity, all is vanity, says the preacher. We come now to the first discourse in Ecclesiastes, which in the formal division of the book is chapters 1 through verse 12 through chapter 2, verse 26. We previously talked about the problems that face us in the study of the book and the concept of the book in the whole. We've also outlined the character of the four major discourses as far as chapter and verse divisions are concerned. So our study in this particular discussion relates to the first of these discourses. I refer to it as the facts of life. Sometimes it's hard to get exactly the right title for somebody else's discourse, and in some way all of Ecclesiastes takes up the facts of life. But in this particular segment, which is 1:12 through 2:26, the writer sets before us some of the hardest of all the things that we have to face in life. These are sometimes elaborated on in latter parts of the book. But as we meet them right here in these particular verses, they come to us in a forceful sort of way that we generally do not particularly enjoy. I call them the facts of life. Not that the facts of life are unpleasant in themselves, but they are sometimes unpleasant in what they reveal to us about our own living status, our own hopes, and our own aspirations. The main point in this first discourse is simply this, that life is not self-sustaining, and all that we bring to it merely increases the futility of it. That's the main point. May I say it again? Life is not self-sustaining, and all that we bring to it merely increases the futility of it. Sounds almost pessimistic when you say it that way, but the emphasis is built upon what we had in the prologue. The world stands still while we come and go, and so life is not self-sustaining. We feel our energies weaken. We feel our days pushing away from us. We feel our opportunities getting smaller. And we may cram life with tons and tons of things, but they only increase the futility of the fact that it is not self-sustaining. Now let me pause and point out that for the believer, that is not a bad thing. The person whose soul is anchored in the truth of Jesus and the salvation he gives knows that he sustains our life, not only in this present world, but particularly in the age to come. He is our life and the length of our days. And of course, in Ecclesiastes, Solomon will come to that point too, where with great rejoicing he will announce that man finds his completion in God and the knowledge of his will. But until we know that, then the facts of life are hard enough, and we discover that life is not self-sustaining, and we may bring ever so many things to it, but they will only increase the basic utility of it as we live and breathe with it day by day. Think of the tragedy of the man with the big retirement plan. He's going to retire with thousands of dollars every month. He has himself a large place in the mountains and a place at the shore. And think of the tragedy of him that the day that he retires, he drops dead of a heart attack. It's a made-up circumstance as far as our lectures are concerned, but we often see it dramatized in life in a really frightening sort of way. And somebody sits back and says, that's too bad. He'd worked for years to have a few days of advantage and a few days for himself. He really put his whole heart and soul into it. And it's gone. Or think, for example, of the individual who worked hard to secure a good station in life for his children. He puts a lot of time into their education and into their resources and all the things that are important to them. And then suddenly they want to have nothing to do with him, but want to live a radical lifestyle quite different from his own. Now, it's too early in our discussion on this particular lecture to get pessimistic about those things, and that really is not my intent. But this great discourse in Ecclesiastes 1:12 and through 2:26 emphasizes that truth. That is its point, that life is not self-sustaining. And what we bring to it merely increases the futility of it. Therefore, we will have to learn to find the sustenance of it in some source external to ourselves. That, of course, eventually is God and in the doing of his will. Now, that's the point of the discourse. The discourse will set forth four basic facts of life, which I will sketch before we look at the actual text. Four basic facts. The first of them is this. We are subject to forces that we cannot control. I'm not saying God can't control them. I'm saying that we can't control them. We are subject to forces that we cannot control. It's an uncomfortable fact of life. You may be overcome with a small virus, or you may be overcome with a terminal illness. I, again, don't want to be negative about it, but that's a force that you can't control. You can take all the preventive medicine that you want and everything that can be supplied to you. And you may walk across the sidewalk and get hit by some kid on a skateboard and knocked into the kingdom. There are forces in life that we cannot control. The second basic fact is that our own attainments are not permanent. Well, I suppose there are some things that when you get them, they can't be taken from you. But you know, you can build a reputation for honesty and make one mistake and lose it. You can build a reputation for truth and tell one lie and have difficulty ever recovering it again. You may plant a forest and have somebody come with a bulldozer and push it down. Our attainments are not permanent. That's a fact of life. But it's a fact of life that growls at us and snarls at us because we don't like to think of it that way. Solomon will make it abundantly plain of that fact. And then the third fact is that there is a common destiny that does not respect us or our desires. In Ecclesiastes 2, that is simply death, a common destiny. Now I know in terms of Christian theology, we expect the Lord to come someday. We expect death to be swallowed up in ultimate victory completely. But as far as life has gone for the last 2,000 years, and as far as it's going today, that has not happened yet. And wise men and fools die on the same time and the same day. You may have a friend who is gifted and intelligent, and he may be buried in a grave next to a town idiot. So there is a common destiny that does not respect us or our desires. And that is not the eternal destiny. The eternal destiny is not common. The eternal destiny depends on your relationship with Jesus Christ and your willingness to trust him and believe in the salvation that God gives. But before the reality of that eternal destiny is yours, there is a common destiny through which we all pass so far. and that common destiny is the reality of death. Wise men, fools, rich men, poor, men and women, slaves and masters, all pass that way. And that's a fact of life, not a comforting one, except for the believer who sees death as the means of entrance into the divine presence, but it is a fact of life. And the fourth fact is the one that satisfaction in living results from contentedness with God dealing. Now that's the big positive fact. Well, they're all positive in their own way, but that's important. Satisfaction in living results not from our being able to control our destiny, not from our attainments, not from having our desires met, but from contentedness with God dealing. That's not a lazy kind of a concept, as I will mention when we get to it in the text of Ecclesiastes 2, but it is an important one. Satisfaction in living results from contentedness with God's being. Now there, friends, are the four basic facts of life as they are espoused in Ecclesiastes 1:12 through 2:26. They are all built around the concept that life is not self-sustaining, and all that we bring to it merely increases the futility of it. But when we recognize the facts, and when we act on them, then we are put into a proper perspective for trusting God and finding real meaning in what we do through doing it in agreement with His will and with His blessing. Now, having gone that far, let us turn to Ecclesiastes 1:12, and let us proceed rather slowly in a number of verses and verse sections in this first discourse. We're working in the first discourse on the facts of life. So we turn to Ecclesiastes 1:12, and here's what we read. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. That introduces this new section. The prologue had been introduced that way also, and now we find the writer picking up the thrust that he gave to us in the prologue, telling us who he was and telling us something of what he did. When he says he mentioned earlier that he was king over Israel and Jerusalem, that does not necessarily imply the United Kingdom, although I privately think that more logically it fits that. I believe Solomon wrote the book. Not all scholars agree. Israel is sometimes used in Scripture to note the northern territory. Sometimes it's used to note the total Jewish people. Sometimes, like in Ezekiel, it just indicates a small remnant of Jews in later ages. But there he is preacher, king, gatherer, instructor over Israel and Jerusalem. So, says the writer in verse 13, I gave my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therein. Well, that's quite a powerful statement. It tells us, as we have suggested before, the enormous amount of background material that the writer of Ecclesiastes had in mind from which he would make his induction. This material was gleaned by the method of giving his heart, that is, putting his whole soul energy into the direct area of finding out the things that are done under heaven. The expression in Ecclesiastes 1:13, to seek and to search, is what we call in Hebrew a parallelism. It involves two basic Hebrew words that are interesting in their scope. One of those is the Hebrew word darash. Darash is the concept of looking minutely for the real thing. Later Jewish scholars would take the word midrash from that, the intense commentary on the various scriptures. So when the writer says, I gave my heart to seek and to search, he means I put my heart, my whole soul being, into a very minute study for real meaning. The second of the words, which in the King James Bible is translated search, is the word which means really to look within yourself. The Hebrew word is the word tur, and it's given with a purpose clause in this connection. And it's the idea as if one were to look carefully for something, while at the same time going in every possible location to seek it. Tur is often used as searching within your heart, looking within yourself, looking within another. So when the writer says, I gave myself to seek and to search out all of these points of wisdom, he means, in effect, I went every place, and I looked in every corner in order that I might know all the things that are done under heaven. Done under heaven is that phrase which, like in the earlier verses, under the sun, the world where we live. In the world where we live, says Solomon, I gave all of my forces to going to every place and to looking in every corner to know what was done among men. He refers to this in Ecclesiastes 1:13 as a sore travail that God has given the sons of men to be exercised therein. And what he means is that there is no possibility of finding out all these things, so the job is bigger than we can hope to accomplish. A sore affliction is given in his own words, God granting to the sons of men a great trial to be exercised therewith, men wanting to know and not being able to find out. Well, I think that the great trial, of course, is the desire that lays in man's mind to know what goes on and to know what God is doing. It becomes a trial to us because the harder we work with it, the less we are actually able to know about it. Great travail and great affliction it is because it involves the total work of one's persons and resources in trying to determine all that is done. And we come up with a kind of a frustrated sense of knowing that we can't know all of those things. Why does Solomon tell us these things? He tells us these things because he wants us to know that the facts of life are not established on some radical ideas, but on a deep search into all the aspects of meaning. So the writer continues that particular thought in verse 14. He says, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. This is what we call an hyperbole. Doesn't mean that he's seen everything, but that he has seen varieties or all types of work that are done under the sun. He has viewed representative specimens of all that was done in his day, and all is vanity and vexation of spirit, as we defined it earlier, meaning that there is nothing permanent to it, and no way you can grab it. Great monuments are made and they crumble. Great statues are erected and others tear them down. Great works of art are done and someone cuts them up and makes firewood of them. Doesn't always happen. But the potentiality is always there. So he says, I went to seek and to search all these things. I looked everywhere. I saw all the things representatively done under the sun, but it is vanity and vexation of spirit. Now, this is not the final conclusion of Ecclesiastes. This is a preliminary conclusion with regard to the facts of life and all that he sees. His mind has been in it, and there is nothing lasting to it. You can argue the point. By the time we finish our studies in Ecclesiastes, arguments come to be almost passé, but you can argue the point if you wish to do so. You can look around and say, do you mean to tell me what I'm doing now has no substance to it? Well, if you are doing it in the attempt to solve the travail that God has given the sons of men, that's about right. If you're doing good works for God, as the writer tells us in the fourth basic fact of life, if you're doing good works for God, there is substance in them, but it's not substance of your own in your own making. It's substance of the enjoyment and contentment of the divine will. Verse 15 of chapter 1 sounds almost morbid. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. I don't think we should understand that that means that there was so much wickedness in the land that nothing could be done about it. But the writer emphasizes that the things that are deformed or out of order are numerous, and that they cannot all be straightened out no matter what you do. You might find a few that you can benefit. And in the areas where things are in short supply and lacking, you're not able to count all of those areas. Think of our world today with the millions of people who are hungry, genuinely hungry. Think of the many who have not the necessities of life. That which is wanting cannot be numbered. And, of course, this book was written many centuries ago, but that concept would have been as true then as it is today. It seems that when one sees all the works of man, looks as hard as he can, he has a conscious awareness that there's a lot that isn't done, and an awful lot more that likely won't be done. Now the writer continues. He says, then I looked in mine heart, and I said, lo, I'm come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. In a sense, the writer is telling us that he talked to himself. I communed with my own heart. My grandfather used to say, it's nice to talk with an intelligent person, and it's nice to hear an intelligent person talk, so it's always good to talk with yourself. And in a sense, that's what Solomon said. He talked to himself, and not inappropriately, to find out what he was thinking. He put his heart to seek and to search, and now he talks with his heart. And he discovers from himself that he's come to great estate and has more wisdom than all that were before me in Jerusalem. In the expression before me, we note that the reference is not temporal so much as it is positional. Solomon is not saying there was no one who ever lived before me in time. who did not know what I know, but that of all those who are about me in Jerusalem now, I have more estate and wisdom than all of those. Before, you'll remember, is used in both ways, in a positional sense and a temporal sense. Here, a positional sense seems to be right. I've got more than anybody else who's around me in Jerusalem. Well, having said that, he tells us that the goods he has collected are enormous in terms of the total community. I have great estate. I am come to it. It is mine. And with it, I have gotten more wisdom. Well, that's important. He had not just amassed things, but with the things had gotten more wisdom. And so with wisdom and his stress on wisdom, he reminds us that he has the ability to make an induction out of what he knows. Wisdom is the ability to apply what you know to the issues of life. So he says, I am come to great estate, and I also have more wisdom than all those who have been before me, all those who stand in my presence. My heart also has great experience of wisdom and knowledge. It's hard to make and hold a continuous distinction between wisdom and knowledge, but we usually say, as I said a moment ago, that wisdom is the capacity to act in a proper and consistent manner, and knowledge is the amassing of a considerable quantity of ideas and materials. So Solomon said, I have a great estate, I have more knowledge and greater wisdom than all those who stand before me. Now that's rather important as far as the total thrust is concerned for what he's going to say. Because he's going to tell us the facts of life, and he's not going to tell them as some idle theorizer, but as someone whose ability to communicate and see what goes on in the world far exceeds that of the average man. So in verse 17, the writer says, I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit. When he says that he has set his heart to know these things, he's telling us in effect that with the wisdom that he had, he did not have a full understanding of the affairs of men. Really wise people often find it hard to understand the giddy and uncomplicated persons that float in society round about them. Now, maybe the people that have that problem are not as wise as we suspect them to be. Maybe we ought to call them learned. But I think I've observed it on all sides. I've found that sometimes people who are very wise can hardly understand why anybody wants to go to a ball game or a picnic or do something silly just for a few moments. And so Solomon, knowing that and having the background of that material, says, I gave my heart to know wisdom, but also to know madness and folly. Madness is best understood not in the sense of being insane, but of throwing oneself recklessly into a given course without regard to good judgment and exercise. That's madness in Ecclesiastes. Madness in Ecclesiastes is not being crazy in a totally legal sense. Madness is jumping into your car and speeding down the road when it's icy without stopping to think when you're going to land up when you can't stop. That's madness in Ecclesiastes. Throwing yourself recklessly into a given course without regard to good judgment exercise. Folly is a kind of a similar word, although it's more closely related to a fool and suggests empty-headedness. So, in giving himself to madness and folly, what he says, is I studied the reckless way in which some live, and I also stopped to look at the empty-headed nonsense that others enjoy. I've always thought that folly, although here I wouldn't want to be judgmental or divisive on it, but I've always thought that folly is like those who laugh at a foolish person, oh, on a television program or some other such thing. Folly is not necessarily bad. It suggests an empty-headed sort of activity. And so the writer said, I had more wisdom than anybody else, but I knew that wasn't everything, so I looked at madness, the reckless behavior of people doing what they wanted to do, and at folly, the empty-headed, giddy, light-hearted feeling that others express as far as life is concerned. I looked at all of those things. And when I looked at all of those things, I perceived that this was vexation of spirit. There is nothing in the great estate. There is nothing in the great wisdom. There is nothing in madness. There is nothing in folly in themselves. For, says the writer in verse 18, in much wisdom is much grief. And he that increases knowledge increases sorrow. Well, as an academic person, I always thought that the increase of knowledge, increasing sorrow, only related to the final examinations of any given course. But the writer is telling us a striking thing. that with the coming of greater wisdom, that's the ability to apply yourself to circumstance of life, comes the greater limitations of not being able to do what you want to do. And with the increase of knowledge, increases sorrow, because you find yourself bound in things that you otherwise did not know about. Therefore, the more one knows, the more his heart is likely to be vexed, and the more his mind is likely to be made sad. I believe in knowledge and in learning and understanding. But I saw an example of it not too long ago, in which a friend of mine was suddenly told that he was cruelly ill, and that nothing could be done to help him. I'm not sure why people say things like that, but that's what they said. They said, nothing can be done to help you. He said to me, kind of half-heartedly, he said, you know, he said, I don't feel any worse, but knowing about it, he said, makes me brood a lot. And so in his case, the increase of knowledge had only made him sadder in the terminal circumstance in which he found himself. Now, this is not the end of Ecclesiastes, but it is the end of chapter 1, and it ties in tightly with the bare facts of life that we mentioned in an earlier consultation. Don't think of those final few verses in Ecclesiastes 1 for a second. The writer says, I put all that I had into learning of wisdom and things that men should do. With that, I got more estate than anybody else. I knew more than anyone else. And I experimented in every possible area of life. And I found that my soul was vexed, because in connection with the facts of life, there are many things I cannot control, and a common destiny lies before me and all others with me. Therefore, if somebody builds a great fund of knowledge and can't use it, or profit by it, or share it, they are the worst for the having had. Now in chapter 2, this theme is continued. In chapter 2, we do not need to look at it so minutely or so much on a verse-by-verse basis. But in chapter 2, it continues. It continued in chapter 2 as the writer tells us about himself and his own possessions in verses 1 through 11. Look at those things with me for a few moments. The writer is going to tell us about himself and about what he knows and what he does in chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. We can almost treat them as a unit. He begins by saying, I said in my heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. That is the King James reading this passage. I will test you with happiness or with giddiness, he says. Therefore enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity. He decides that having had all this wisdom and having had all these things, have not done so much for him, so he will now give his heart to mirth. The word which is translated mirth, incidentally, is a word which is often translated joy or rejoicing. It is not a bad word. Madness and folly, they are generally words not used in a healthful connection, but mirth is often translated rejoicing. It comes out of the semach concept in Hebrew, the oil of rejoicing, and that which is poured in the head of the priest to institute is rejoicing. So the word in itself is not a bad word, in fact, a rather good one. He says, I gave my heart to mirth in order that I might find what was there, and said, enjoy pleasure, found that this also was vanity. So I said of laughter in verse 2, it's mad. If mirth, what does it do? Laughter is reckless. Mirth, what does it do? And the emphasis is that it doesn't do anything. Well, for a moment, it makes you feel lightheaded and giddy and happy for a moment, but ultimately, it doesn't do anything. It passes and it's gone, because the man who laughs today may be crying tomorrow, and the heart that's filled with joy today may tomorrow be overburdened with its own sorrows and its own grief. So, says the writer, with that particular thing in mind, I took my heart to give myself, in verse 3, unto wine, yet at the same time acquainting mine heart with wisdom. I saw that round about me a lot of people indulged themselves in happy beverages, and so he said, I did it too. I kept my wisdom. I did not lose my wisdom. I kept my wisdom. But in keeping with my wisdom, I entered into all the things that men do that relieve their pressures. I laid hold on folly so that I might see what was good for the sons of men, which they should do under heaven all the days of their life. I hate to be too repetitious about it, but you see, here's what he says. He's saying, I tried to determine what was best for people. And the place of advantage which I had as king, with all my estate, with all my wisdom, with all my experimental ability, I tried to determine what was best for people. And I discovered that it wasn't wisdom, that it wasn't knowledge, that it wasn't madness, that it wasn't folly, that it wasn't mirth, that it wasn't wine. And yet those are the things that people put endless amount of time on. So then the writer looks at his own works in greater detail. He does it in the passage starting in verse 4 and going down through verse 9. I think I will not look at those verses on an individual basis with you, but they stand out in stark relief against what most of us have. We discover that he had a great home. We discover that he had great vineyards, that great trees abounded there. There were the pools of water. I've always imagined that at least two or three of them were trout pools myself, and he could go out in any given afternoon and pull in a rainbow trout for, you know, a fish sandwich or something like that. But there are the pools of water. And there are the things, the trees that grow round about them. In addition to that, there are servants, persons to do his bidding. He has great possessions of cattle and all the things that are about. He has more of it than anybody else does. And along with it, silver and gold and the peculiar things that kings want. A whole choir of persons to sing to him when he's sick. And he concludes in verse 9 that he was great and increased more than anybody else in his presence in Jerusalem. And what's more, his wisdom remained with him. Now you have to pause there just for a moment and comment on the abundance of the stuff that he had. All of us would like to have more things. And most of us really think, although the Lord Jesus denied it, but most of us really think that a few more things would greatly enrich our lives. Well, says the writer of Ecclesiastes, look at what I had. Look at what I had. And with what I had, I kept my wisdom. And in verse 10, anything that I wanted, that my eyes saw, I did not keep them from it. I took what I wanted, and my heart rejoiced in my labor and all the things that I did. But then I looked on these works, and all was vanity and vexation of spirit. None of these works could keep him. None of these works could sustain him. All that he possessed, he would pass by and leave someday in the course of life. And that, friend, is the great basic fact of life. Work your fingers to the bone. Build bigger barns. Pile up greater accounts. But someday, as we will see in a few verses, it will be left to somebody else, and you will have to do decently or indecently without it. Now, that is almost harsh. And yet that's the problem we face with people in our day and age in getting them to see the facts of life. The only reason we want to see those facts is so that we will see the force of them is contentedness through the knowledge of God and will be delivered from our own self-striving into the enjoyment of God and his will. And so the writer of Ecclesiastes has done that already for us, you see. He says, I have experimented in everything. And in the abundance of all these things, and have found them only to be vanity and vexation of spirit. It's a sad note in verse 11 when he says there was no prophet under the sun. The word prophet means there was nothing left over to me under the sun. There was no abundance for me. There was nothing that remained for me. Because, you see, he is moving on as all generations move on. And all of these things remain for somebody else and for somebody else's disposition. Now there's quite a shift in thought in verse 12. Quite a shift in thought. In verse 12, the writer says, I turned myself, and I often pause here and say he turned himself again. He thought he'd like to have a second look at some of these things. He'd seen them before, but now he'd like to look at them again, because now he can look at them in the light of all that he possessed and the emptiness of it all. So having gotten all these possessions, and having seen that they are not permanent, now he turns again to look once more at wisdom, the ability to act consistent, at madness, the reckless dashing living, at folly, the empty-headed and kind of senseless behavior. I turn to look at all of those things. I turn to look at them again. They will look to him exactly the same way that they did before, but I turn to look at them because, he said, what can anyone do that comes after the king? What can anybody who follows me, what more can he do? He can only do that which has already been done. So in effect, says the writer, I had gone through a cycle. I had observed and studied these things and noted them in the force, and then I turned to look at them again. and I observed that nobody else could do more than I had done. It merely means that the man who follows me will be unable to find any means of expressing himself more satisfactorily than that which Solomon or the writer had already done. It's a grim prospect. But what he's saying to you is, don't imagine that you can do something different than I did that will make the end result different. Don't imagine that. Now again, forgive me, we will put all things into perspective with his knowledge of God after a bit, but here he's giving us the facts of life, and the facts are that you cannot control the circumstances about you ultimately, and that we are moving towards a common destiny, and there's nothing you can do that is different than what has already been done. Oh, I understand some people are trying to freeze themselves in ice so they can come back, but that's already been tried a couple times, too. Now, as we push ahead in chapter 2, the writer knows in verses 13 through 17 that wisdom is better than folly. He knows that. He knows that because wisdom exceeds folly like light exceeds darkness. And the wise man has an advantage in verse 14. He can see where he's going and the fool doesn't. But the wise man who can see where he's going and the fool who can't, one event waits for them all. He tells us this in verses 15 and 16. One event waits for them all, and that's death. Death is not the end of things in Ecclesiastes, but death is the end of this immediate sphere of existence in Ecclesiastes or anywhere else. And so the writer says, I look and see that one event is ahead of them all, and somehow when that event comes, it doesn't make any difference whether the man is a wise man or a fool. That's what is meant in verse 16 when it says, there is no remembrance of the wise more than the fool. It means that in the moment of death, death does not stop and look at you and say, oh, you're a wise man, I'll give you 10 more years. Or you're a fool, you should have died last month. There is no more recognition of one or the other in the processes of death. I've always enjoyed walking through cemeteries and computing the ages of persons when they die. Kind of a morbid habit, but I've always rather liked to do it. And in almost any good cemetery, forgive me, you'll find those that died in their infancy, a few hours old, and you'll find some that lived to be 100 or more. You'll discover that no one has a separate section in the cemetery for the wise and for the fool. You'll discover that no cemetery has a separate section in which it says, when it came time to die, the death angel looked at this man and said, oh, you're a wise man, we're going to spare you a prolonged. Not at all. Not all of it is true that if a person is wise, he may deliver himself from certain grievous faults that rub out the lives of fools. But the ultimate moment of destiny is very much the same. And therefore, says the writer in verse 17, I hated life. I hated life. I took an object attitude towards life because it could not be continued. It could not be contained. And all the things that were done under the sun were vanity and vexation of spirit. I cannot hang on to them, and they cannot sustain me. Now that particular thought, depressing though it may be, is picked up in verse 18 and elaborated on in the next several verses, actually down through verse 23. They stand together as a unit too. And in that unit of thought, the writer says, I hated all my labor. Why? Because I would leave it to the man who came after me. Now there is one of the big facts of life, you see. We are not self-sustaining. There is a common destiny ahead of all of us, and the things that we amass will not help us to prevent it or miss it. And so I left it to someone who came after me, and who would know whether he was a wise man or a fool. I think verses 18 through 23 need fairly little elaboration. But the writer says, you know, I gleaned a lot of things for myself, and I've witnessed a man who had great labor and wisdom and knowledge and equity, and yet when he was gone, he left all that he had. He left. That's what everybody does when they go. The Scots had the old expression that the shrouds had no pockets. But that's what everyone does when he goes. When he goes without his labors. He goes without his books. He goes without his papers. In term of full Christian theology, whatever he has sent on ahead to Christ, whatever he's done for the Lord, that has gone before him. But when he goes without any of these things that he's amassed. And all these things that he's amassed are left to those who come after him. And who knows, says the writer, whether the man who comes after him will be a wise man or a fool. I do not have a very exhaustive library. I have a complete set of Zane Grey and a few other things like that that are fairly important to me, and I enjoy them. And I also have boxes of papers that I've collected over many years that really don't amount to anything. I still have homework assignments from the third grade stored here and there. Not many. A lot of them weren't worth saving, but a few. And my wife has often assured me that if I were to depart for heaven tomorrow, one day later, an awful lot of my stuff would be thrown out in the trash. Now, I do not get morbid about that, but I must say it bothers me just a little to think that I have saved, my third grade papers and someone is going to throw them out. That's a childish sort of thing. But you may have worked on some project that didn't even mean. Oh, you may have created a violin like some of the great masters have done. You may, and somebody may remember it, but you won't get any of the money of it when it's sold for resale 200 years from now. Stradivarius, or whatever his name was, hasn't collected a penny of royalty in 200 years. And I won't brood on that longer either. But that's the fact of life. And so the writer says, I hated all of these things. That doesn't mean he had no use for them. It means he hated them by virtue of comparison. I couldn't keep them. I couldn't hold them. And so in a recriminating way, I looked at them and said, well, what difference do they make for me? Now in verses 24 through 26, his mood turns to a more positive sense. He has told us the facts of life, and now he tells us the very positive thing with regard to God. He says, therefore, he said, there's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink. That's not an Epicurean philosophy, but note how it goes, that he should eat and drink and make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw that it was from the hand of God. When he says there's nothing better, that's a comparative statement. It means that there's nothing better for you than to be content in what God gives you. To take it, to eat it, and to drink it. To take it and to use it and to enjoy it. God may give you the grace to multiply it 1,000 times so that you may become as rich as a king, but there still will be nothing better for you than to take what God gives and to enjoy it thankfully for him. The problem that we face is often we look at what God has given us and it doesn't seem to be enough, and our eyes flit hither and thither in great covetousness wanting other things. But the writer says that's where you're wrong. The summum bonum, the very best good, is to be content with what God gives. Who can eat, or who else can hasten unto any more than I can, says Solomon? Who knows it better than I do? Who's had more, and who's had more complaining? Who's had more, and who's had more soul grief? Who's had more, and who's had more struggle than I? And the answer rhetorically is no one. So, he says, I've learned this with my wisdom and knowledge, that the great blessing is to be contented with what God gives. For God gives to a man that's good in his sight wisdom, knowledge, and joy. To the sinner, he gives travail. The man who is good in his sight is the man who trusts God, who honors God. The sinner is the man who insists on his own way and his own ends. And so he says, that man travails, he gathers, he heaps up, and eventually he will leave it to somebody else that God will give it to. That he may give to the one that is good before God. The sinner heaps up things that cannot help him, and eventually may be passed on to others to whom God will share them. The whole matter, he said, is vanity and vexation of spirit. You can't grab onto it. You can't hold to it. Now, the first, of course, is very important in that particular connection because it stresses the facts of life, which facts we have to believe if we are going to know how to organize and appoint ourselves properly. And those facts of life, as I mentioned at the start of this discussion, are simple. We are subject to forces we cannot control. Therefore, it's important that we look to God. Our attainments are not permanent. Therefore, it's important that our hope not be in them, but God who blesses us and allows us to know and to do. There is a common destiny that does not respect us or our desires. Therefore, it's important that our concentration be not on it, but on God and his will and blessing for us. And there is a satisfaction in living that results from contentedness with God's dealings. And that becomes the great burden of the evidence and truth in Ecclesiastes. In order to get us to see that and to see it clearly, the writer has to undercut everything else. I've often had students read Ecclesiastes and say, well, this statement is too harsh, or that statement is too sharp, or that one is too severe. And to a certain extent, they are right in that judgment. But the point for which those statements are given is to take from us all effort of self-salvation, that we might learn to look not to self, not to life, not to good, not to attainment, but to God. And when we are willing to be content with what God provides, then the knowledge of Him and His blessings will fill our lives and keep us strong. Now we will just continue there, and then we will begin looking soon in chapter 3 at the second discourse.
This series is continued on the next cassette. Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog or other information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.